And good morning.
There we go. Got a little sound going on there. Welcome to We the People, where we do it differently every week. We should call it We the Change-Up Artists.
Well, if you're wondering why we didn't have the theme music this morning, my computer is totally locked up at the moment, so we decided to just...
We had nothing.
Go unplugged.
We had a little homeless snack there out front for you. Did you see that? You stopped for a snack on your way in?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it's like hors d'oeuvres, but not really.
I had a situation at home.
Oh, really?
Yes. But I am.
And I'm having one at work. So.
Wow.
You can.
I did forget my phone. I had to send Bill home for it.
Go ahead and.
Okay, I guess we're all having a situation.
Chat while I attempt to unlock the computer here.
Visit amongst yourselves.
So what, did we tell everybody how to join us?
No. We just started talking cold turkey there right out of nowhere. Then you came in.
Yeah, and then I came in. So if you want to give us a call, because we love that, it's 530-605-4567.
Oh, we already have William Kay on the line. One of us was like up on time.
Want to jump on the chat room and join the frivolity? Go to wethepeopleradio.us. You will also find our webpage, everything about today's guest. And every guest that we've had for close to 2.5 years.
Exactly.
Individual links to email out on a variety of topics under the umbrella of limited government, adherence to the Constitution, and fiscal responsibility, which seems to be...
The old fiscal responsibility
gag.
Yeah,
the fiscal responsibility seems to be a mirage, something that people vaguely remember at some point
back in the
past.
Oasis of our childhood.
Yeah.
And then they weren't really doing it then either, the more you learn about what was going on.
Yeah.
Years ago, it's okay, there is no perfection. So, Robert Exter and I I'm going to use the term, we were working on the webpage loosely. I was on the phone and Robert was actually doing all the work.
There you go.
thanks, Robert. We came up with this, the idea for the title for our show since we didn't know what to call it. So we just called it, Unfortunately, It's All True.
Oh, I love that.
So we thought if we were going to bring William on and we were going to talk about whatever he wants to talk about, we needed a broad scope here.
I love it when we have guests that come from other areas because it's almost like being in space and looking back at the Earth. I want to know what people in Canada think about what's going on in the U.S. because fast forward, they're kind of ahead of the game there a little bit.
Yeah, they're doing some different stuff. Do we have William in there?
Oh, yeah.
Have him locked in a box somewhere?
He's ready to go.
Is he? William, are you in there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hey, now we can hear you. We're having a little computer issue this morning. And with the computer issue comes lack of sound.
So, good morning.
So, we got it
morning.
It fixed.
You need sound on radio.
Sound is good.
It works so much better.
Sound is good. We interviewed...
Funny how
that
works.
I don't know who we had on the show one time. I forget who it was, but they were kind of a nodder. And they were actually in the studio. And it's like the nodding really doesn't go through very well. It was
unless they hit their head on the microphone.
That's Elizabeth's job. We don't want to yeah.
There you go.
We don't
just get it over with.
We don't want to steal her shtick.
She's so pounding her head on the microphone this morning.
There's usually some sort of arm flailing that gets tangled in the microphone too at some point.
Because I speak with body language.
Yeah, with the hands.
Yeah, with the hands
using
and the arms
hands.
And anything that flails.
So, down here, I guess of note, I did snoop around a little bit on the internet last night and walking that dog this morning. I noticed some newspapers laying in my neighbor's driveways and the gun rallies were all over.
All over the nation.
Yep, all over the place. So Dick Wilkinson here in Reading, I think, was on the front page of the paper this morning. I didn't have my glasses on, but it looked a lot like Mr. Wilkinson.
It was. I read it.
Was it? Okay.
I read it. And
why didn't I wear my glasses?
Interestingly enough, they had the largest single turnout, it appears, in New York City, where, of course...
the gun grabbers are on steroids.
Where they have just passed the strictest gun laws in the nation, and that is where they had the biggest turnout. So,
nice.
Yeah. Yeah, 2,000 people.
Oregon, too. They had a couple
Oregon's
thousand.
Going crazy.
I know. They had a couple thousand people up there.
I mean, which is really interesting because their sheriffs have jumped on board fast.
Exactly. Well, hey, William, do you guys get that? Are you guys following that stuff up there? And did they already take all your guns?
Oh, yeah. We get blasted with American media up here. Much of our news sources are American.
Did you guys... Do you guys have guns or not?
We have guns?
I'm a little weak on what's going on in Canada. Educate
well, us. Right now I'm looking at the list of guns per capita in the world. We're not up there with the United States, but we're close.
Nice.
Certainly in the more rural areas, like where Alberta and places like that where I'm at now, it'd be pretty much the same in terms of guns per capita. We don't have a Second Amendment right to guns. There was a lot of controversy about them creating a registry where everyone had to register their firearms, but they dropped that. For all intents and purposes, we do have a right to bear arms in Canada. And this is a fairly heavily armed country in terms of private arms.
Nice.
Very similar to America.
Does your government attempt to clamp down on your gun ownership? Do they create or take advantage of situations that allow them to jump in and say, oops, we need to make a law for that?
We just went through that. The current regime in Ottawa, in the federal government, is moving in the other direction. Previous to that, there was a big push to force all citizens to make a list of all their firearms and submit that to the police department, and that has just been abandoned.
And
so
why,
there was a big
why is
gun
that?
Control.
Did people just
why
refuse?
Did they abandon it?
Yeah, did people just refuse to do it?
They were not doing it, and it was extremely unpopular.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Even though we don't have a constitutional right to bear arms, that mentality is quite prevalent in Canada. So there were people who didn't want to do that, and due to just relentless grassroots agitation, the government backed down on that. Mm-hmm. And right now, there was a change of government several years ago, and there was a long period of minority governments. But the upshot is that is off the table, and it will be for some time.
Good. Well, that's cool.
Great.
Yeah, it's funny. Gun rights are something that it's kind of hard to take away because you actually have to take something away from people physically.
Yeah.
And, when it fires bullets, it's just harder than other things.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Plus, the 49th parallel is the longest undefended border in the world, and it would be very difficult to control guns in Canada if they were not controlled in America. There's quite a traffic back and forth across that border of all kinds of things, so it would be very difficult for them to do that in Canada
because
we live so close to the United States.
And that border just goes on, but the other border, disaster area, we don't even get into that. So we don't have much of a bio on you, William. People are like, well, who is this guy? He's got a website, ecofascism.com, which has made him incredibly popular with folks like us, but it's also it made you what, notorious with the other people?
Yeah, I'm not someone who really believes in splashing your face and address all over the internet. People still do that, but I think that's not going to be going on for too much longer. There's an old saying that a life well hidden is a life well lived. I'm not really...
I didn't know that one.
the sort of stuff that I put out really does irritate people in a major way, and I'm working on a new posting. I've been helping out some mainstream news with this, which is unusual. But the new posting is on this sort of Indian uprising, and when I post this one, I'll have even more enemies. So it's good to sort of keep a low profile.
So hiding in the open isn't your strategy.
No, I know people who have their face and their birth date and all this sort of stuff all over the internet. I don't think that's too smart in this day and age.
No, and then pictures of all their kids and their kids' kids and their nieces and nephews and
I've come across a number of stories that people who were doing that, then they became very politically active and they get targeted, and it's very easy for the bad people to find out all about you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had a few security guys on here, and they said, the easiest way to go find somebody is Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Just whatever you want to know, just go to Facebook. You know everything about them.
I am just floored by what people put on there. Just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. It works both ways. One of the pieces I'm working on now is sort of profiling who are the leaders of this uprising. And you can get a lot of data about them off the internet, including a lot of data they'd probably rather you not have. So it works both ways.
So what's the I had no idea. I was watching some of the videos just for folks that are tuned in here. WeThePeopleRadio.us has a page up today. It says, unfortunately, it's all true, with our guest William Kay. And down below it has has five different videos of what's going on up there with your... Now, are they American Indians, or are these folks... I mean, are Eskimos?
They're Canadian Indians.
They're Canadian Indians. I mean, yeah, sorry, North American Indians is what I meant to say.
They didn't come all the way up here from this. Actually, some of them did, if you know the history of these people. Because,
yeah, what's the deal? Anyway, it's just like we don't even think about that.
This is unprecedented. I've been living, I've only, you know, spent a few years of my life outside of Canada. I spent about a year in Europe and a year or so in the States. I've been to the States a number of times. But you're talking to someone who spent, you know, almost his entire life in Canada, and I've never seen anything like this. This is a pretty much coast-to-coast Indian uprising. I would say in the last month, there's been several hundred demonstrations. There's been over 100 illegal blockades of highways and railways, and some of them are getting quite nasty. And it's difficult to see in the future how far this is going to go and how violent this is going to get. In Canada, we've been living under the threat, like the open, articulated threat of violence for about 30 years. Mm-hmm. I couldn't count the number of times Indians have made public statements that they're about to go ballistic and engage in an armed uprising. We've seen three or four small instances like that, you know, where the army or heavy police forces have had to go into rural areas and clean out. Minor armed uprisings over the last 20 years. But this is something different. It's far larger than anything I've ever seen, or anything that's actually ever happened in Canada.
And you guys have, just like we do, you have reservations and different things like, you have the similar, because they were talking about treaties that were broken and different things with their tribal land and,
set
up like we are?
It's a bit different. Okay, I'll give you some context. The thing that Americans would be forgiven for not knowing was that Canada is actually a larger country in terms of area than is the United States. Canada is about 3.85 million square miles. America is about 3.8. So if you can visualize that, it's a huge area. Point number two, California has a larger population than Canada.
The entirety
The state of California has a population of 38 million people. Canada has a population of 33.5 million people. So, you know, California almost has 5 million more people than the entire country of Canada.
Wow.
Yet Canada is bigger than the entire United States.
That's a trip. I don't know.
So you have to visualize,
it's one of those things we don't think
Alaska.
About.
Alaska on steroids. Alaska without all the people. That's Canada. And most Canadians live right along the south. So if you can get to that, like where you're dealing with a country that has a very low population density and this vast hinterland. Now of that 33.5 million people, there's about 1.3 million people, or less than 4% of the population, who, quote-unquote, self-identify as Indian. And you remember Elizabeth Warren?
I was just gonna make a crack about that, and I'm like, just allow the man to speak.
Well, Canada's got 500,000 Elizabeth Warren.
That's 500,000.
I can't recall how many times in my life I've talked to somebody who's, as white as the freshly fallen snow, and then they tell me they're an Indian. You get all kinds of benefits in Canada if you are a status Indian. You get free dental care. You get your post-secondary education fully paid for with daycare. If you're living on a reserve and you're a status Indian, you do pay no taxes whatsoever. There's many benefits that befall people who have status Indian recognition. And there's of that 1.3 million, about 850,000 are status Indians. And there's a whole bunch of sort of half Indians or people, or 1/16th Indian who are trying to get status. Even for those people, there's all sorts of benefits in terms of employment and housing. So it pays to be an Indian. So as a result of that, just like Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, it worked out for her in college.
A certain box, it was great for her career.
Sure.
And of course, she was an absolute liar. She has no Indian ancestry at all.
Yeah, it's funny. She doesn't want to be listed in their little registry or whatever it was in their history thing. She's like, no, it's okay. I don't really.
No, yeah. The chief genealogist of the Cherokee Nation has come out quite firmly saying this person, there's no evidence whatsoever that her family was Cherokee. And they went the extra mile of researching Elizabeth Warren's family tree, and there's no evidence of any Cherokees in there. No, this is just an absolute fabrication that she made
up. Oh, that's fun.
We
didn't hear that, or I didn't hear that. Hey, we've got to take a really quick break. But for people that are going, hey, what do I care about an Indian uprising in Canada besides the fact you just learned how big the country is, which was probably a news flash to most of us, this connects up with the environmental movement. So we haven't
most certainly.
We haven't just gone off the reservation here, actually. We are we're still talking about the environmentalists.
Pun intended, I'm sure.
I'm sure it won't be the last time I say that. You are listening to We the People Radio here at KCNR 1460 AM Community Radio for the North State.
Of life, the tomahawk and the bow and knife took away our native tongue and taught their English to our young.
Okay, Bob, this totally makes up for the fact that there was no music at the beginning.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
And so for all the people that's actually true,
mm-hmm.
you know, for somebody to come sliding in and...
Yeah,
oh, that's sure. My history.
Hey, so, William, when you talk about all of the benefits to those that have any heritage...
Contact tool.
He's on another line, I think.
Are you there, William?
I'm
there.
He's blowing us off.
I'm glad you didn't get that.
Are you on the phone, William?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hey, so when you were talking about all the benefits that anybody with any Indian heritage receives, does that create the same kind of welfare state that we've got in America?
Oh, Canada is far further down the path of welfare statehood than America is.
Wow.
And Indians are the vanguard of that.
Oh,
you're not even close.
Wow.
Really?
No. America is the great land of free enterprise from our point of view.
Mm.
Yikes.
This is, and particularly with the natives, I would say 95% of them are on some kind of government support. 95%. Like, you know, either fake jobs or jobs within the Aboriginal industry or straight out on welfare. You know, 95%.
And what's paying for this?
John Q. taxpayer.
Wow. What's your tax rate there?
Higher than America. It varies from province to province. Basically, you know, I think in terms of like 25 to 50% of the income tax, plus their sales tax in almost every province except Alberta. And the sales tax can be as high as 10% on every purchase.
Jeez.
Unless you're an Indian.
Wow.
In which case you sidestep all that.
Okay. Well, a little more context, and to tie it in with this environmental thing.
Cool.
The current government in Ottawa, the federal government of Canada, has issued statements saying that this is the economic strategy for Canada, is to really focus on resource extraction. In their current economic blueprint, they say there's about $700 billion and the currencies are pretty much at the same right now, worth of mining projects that are ready to go right now. And about 8 or 9 months ago, they issued a large piece of legislation that revamped environmental assessments in Canada. And it was a very much a step in a positive direction. They went away from this whole labyrinthine system of multiple regulatory bodies to a one-window, one-stop affair where a mining company or a oil company can lay their blueprint down, and within 1 year they'll get a yes or no, as opposed to the previous system, which is what you have in the United States, where, as you know, there's multiple government agencies involved in these, and it takes years and years to get anything approved, and quite often projects get killed because it just takes too long for them to get environmental approval. So when the federal government streamlined and fast-tracked the system about 9 months ago, the environmental movement went furious, and there were national protests and filibustering in Parliament. It was a major media item for about a month, but the bill got pushed through. Now there's a subsequent bill that also further fast-tracks environmental activism and slightly modifies the Indian Act, which governs Indian relations. And this time the environmental movement really played the Indian card. And much of the Native propaganda, or the media interpretation of the Native propaganda, has been focusing on the fact that, you know, the Indians are the ones that are going to protect the environment. The evil government and the mining companies are going to come and destroy Canada. But the general thinking, and it's accurate thinking, is that Canada will never be a great manufacturing hub, will never be a great tourist center. You know, I'm looking out my window, it's 30 below here. People aren't going to want to come here. Our real ace in the hole, our comparative advantage, is the natural resources. It's the mining, it's the forestry, it's the oil and gas.
Sure.
That is how we are going to make a living. So what the international environmental movement is doing is using this puppet sub-movement of aboriginals to, you know, they're openly calling for these legislations to be repealed, even though they've been fully passed.
Wow. So, okay, so give me some, like when you said that the environmental restrictions were just so great that there are so many things that you can't get done. I mean, we're seeing that too. There are some projects that make, that would make a lot of sense, and everybody kind of looks, I think people kind of look at each other and go, yeah, it's probably never going to happen.
Well, I can refer you to a document of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce called Project No Project. I condensed it on my website. But it gives you a list of, I think, 350 major energy projects in the United States that have been killed by environmental activism over the last several years. And, you know, it's probably $1 trillion worth of, you know, gas-fired power plants and coal-fired power plants and, gas liquefaction plants that were, you know, blocked. And usually the strategy is just to drag it out, like to get people involved in protracted regulatory and litigatory disputes. That, you know, after several years, the investors give up. You know, it takes so much time for the people promoting the project to get all their ducks in a row, to get all their investors in a row, that those investors aren't going to stick around for years while the thing drags on. So in Canada, it was a step in the right direction to move towards a fast-track, one-window operation where there wasn't going to be multiple levels of government and there wasn't going to be multiple bureaucracies to deal with. But, of course, that's exactly what the Green Movement did not want to see.
Yeah, but that makes sense.
There's a whole other aspect to this because, you know, the media is just so deceptive. And they will focus on certain things and they actually censor certain information. And this happens in the States as well. But, you know, we have reserves in Canada, as we were talking about, Indian reserves. There's several hundred of them. And over the last 20 years, they've all rebranded themselves. They no longer refer themselves as reserves. They're all called First Nations. So what was the Beaver Lake Reserve is now the Beaver Lake First Nation. And we all, you know, we can't call them Indians anymore. We have to call them First Nations.
We do?
And, oh, yeah. You know, it's one of the peculiarities of Canada. Even though we've got the Indian Act, it's now an insult to call someone an Indian.
Oh.
Even though the Indians call themselves Indians generally. But they keep sort of changing the name. We had to call them, you know, first they were Indians, then they were Natives, then they were Aboriginals. Now they're First Nations. And every sort of 3 or 4 years, they come up with a new word that we have to call them by. Otherwise, you're being a racist.
So if you were to ask, I don't know, if you met someone and you were having some conversation, would they say, "Hi, I'm a First Nation"? I mean,
depending on their, political point of view, they would identify themselves by which particular First Nation they belong to.
Okay.
Like Cree, Chippewyan, Inuit. Eskimo is also a racist term. We can't use that word anymore.
That's funny. I was going to ask you if these were Eskimos.
So what are we going to do about Eskimo pies?
Oh, they're out.
It is now called Inuit pie.
Better hurry up
and get
them.
They're now Inuits. There will be Inuits for a few years until somehow Inuit will become an insult, too.
Just about the time we get the hang of it.
And we'll have to come up with a new one. But here's the rub.
Mm-hmm.
These reserves, and there's only about 400,000 or 500,000 people that actually live on them. Most of the natives in Canada live in cities. They have fled these reserves. These reserves are notorious tribal dictatorships. On almost every one of these reserves, there's a small clique of people around the chief who take all the money and they keep everyone else in abject poverty, living in shacks and rags, and they invite the media up to look at this great poverty, and there's a huge media story about what a shameful place Canada is, how we treat the Indians so poorly. Well, there's many, many chiefs. I think the Canadian Taxpayers Foundation did a study of it. There's over 100 Indian chiefs making more money than the Prime Minister.
Wow. Now you're
it's big money being an Indian chief.
No, are
you you're basically just, absolutely ripping off your band members. There was a judge in Alberta wrote a book about a local reserve. He was a judge in a town near the reserve, and he couldn't figure out why, if they were only 10% of the population, why were they 80% of the people he was seeing in the criminal courts? So he looked into it, and the reserve was run by a chief called the Dr. Reverend Chief Snow. He had this elaborate title. He was stealing millions of dollars from the reserve. He was keeping the people on the reserve on $200 a month welfare. He was looting the welfare budget. He was using the drug rehab money to buy racehorses.
He got
so tired of the other members of the reserve bumming money off him that he moved the band council meetings to hotels in Las Vegas.
Wow.
And that story gets told hundreds of times in Canada. And, even some of the main protesters, there's a chief from Ontario who's currently on a hunger strike at the foot of Parliament Hill right now. I helped break this story, but her household income is $300,000 a year, and that's tax-free. And the dollars, that's like earning $300,000 U.S. a year tax-free.
That'd be all right.
She's complaining.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, it's a good living. They're just absolutely ripping off their own bands. So one of the pieces of legislation that's currently working its way through government is called the Indian Band Financial Transparency Act. And it is going to require all 630 of those bands to post their full financial statements online and with the government. And that is going to cause, another Indian uprising, because there's a lot of absolutely dirt poor natives in this country who have no idea how much money their chiefs are making. I'll just tell you an example of what an absolute ripoff
this is. Kind of like union bosses.
Exactly. Because most union members, they don't know how much money those guys are making.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
And if you make a fuss, they'll give you problems. And that's exactly. There are Indians on Canadian reserves who have made a fuss about how much money the chief is making. They come home, their house is on fire.
Oh.
They get death threats.
Whoops.
Straight up, and they eventually get driven off the reserve. And so it's just the chief and his family and that clique. There's a chief on the East Coast. There's less than 300 people on his reserve, and he's paying himself almost $1 million a year. It's like $980,000 a year, tax-free. He's probably stealing, $15,000 to $20,000 from each household on his reserve. And there's almost no discussion of this in the mass media. It's not across the board. There's a few mass media outlets that are talking about this. But generally, the progressive sort of university, well-meaning do-gooder crowd, if you bring this topic up, you're a racist.
Of course.
So, you know,
although
sort of
it's the center. Just corruption. I mean, it's just your garden variety corruption within a specific group.
Mm-hmm. And the federal government, you know, tolerated this and has tolerated this for generations. The, you know, the most galling thing of all is the woman who's doing the sort of fake hunger strike on Parliament Hill. You know, the government did audit their books, and not only is she, like, she's paying her common-law husband $850 a day to manage the town. The reserve has a population of 1,500 people. Like, in most non-native towns, the mayor is probably a volunteer. If it's only like 1,000 people or so, the mayor is a volunteer job, or he's making an extra $10,000 a year. But, you know, on a native reserve, you know, sometimes there's one in Manitoba. It's a reserve of 3,000 people, you know, probably 25 people employed by the reserve council, which would be like a town council. Several of them are making over $200,000 a year. But the woman is doing the hunger strike. They audited their books, you know, just millions upon millions of dollars missing. They estimate that reserve has received about $110 million from the federal government over the last several years. 60% of that money, there isn't a single receipt.
Oh.
It's just going up in smoke. And all those reserve, you know, many people have these no-show jobs. You know, they're a crisis counselor, they're a daycare worker, whatever. They don't really actually show up at the job. It's like the mafia. You know, whenever these big construction projects go up, all the wise guys get these no-show jobs. They get paychecks as though they're on the site, but they're not. That's rampant across Canada if you're on the inside in these reserves. So, to a large degree, what's motivating this protest is, you know, there's a few hundred of these band councils that just fear the daylight. They fear that if they really have to expose their books, there's going to be an uprising from their own people against them. And that's one of the motivating factors. So it's this absolutely unholy, ghoulish alliance between these corrupt tribal dictators and the international environmental movement.
Man. All right, we need to take a quick break. We're going to come back and
follow
look
that
at
train.
Look at how we're the same but different. You are listening to We the People Radio. We're here with William Kay. We'll be right back with you in 2 minutes for KCNR 1460 AM Community Radio for the North State.
I'm an Indian outlaw. Half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa. Oh, she's a one of a kind. All my friends call me Bear Claw. The village chicken is my pawpaw. He gets his orders from my mama. She makes him walk the line.
Indian lady is a sin you should make with your little
Welcome back. You are joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan, Elizabeth Woodward, Bob Martin, and our very special guest, William Kay, our roving reporter from the great country of Canada up north. And just wanted to...
We should call it the great landmass.
Yes.
Now that we have some factual information.
Hey, and just wanted to let you know that if you are attempting to listen to us streaming live, we are having audio difficulties. We are scrambling to try to rectify that. Don't give up. But, you know, whenever you bring a new system in, it's got bugs to work out. So patience is a virtue.
Yes, we.
And also give us a call at 530-605-4567. And we're chatting. Go to wethepeopleradio.us. Join us. Everything about today's guest.
For the record, you can still listen to us on AM 1460.
Yes, you can.
But if you're trying to listen
what?
On
use
your computer.
Use the real radio?
Yes, use the real radio. Our new... bulletproof streaming system that was supposed to replace the old system that was having intermittent issues is now apparently having issues of its own this morning. So
and it needs a password, and we tried all the good stuff.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Bad idea to make it require a password.
Okay. I tried passwords because a lot of times it's password. Yeah. No. Oh, I didn't try the phone number, though. Try that.
I'm going to try contacting our webmaster and
what a good
let
idea.
Him fix it. All right.
All right. So... Where were we? William, are you keeping notes on this? Are you paying attention?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank goodness.
Where did we leave off,
thank goodness.
William?
We're just having
I'm
a little...
my own biggest fan. Don't worry.
Right on. We are just
I
having...
listen to every word I say.
We're having chaos over here.
It happens.
But you know what? I'm super interested about this idea that the environmental community, because, see, we see this here, too. We're seeing this, I think the closest local crossover that we would see would be with the Klamath Dam issue. And with coho salmon and all that kind of stuff. And you see the Karuk tribe connected with the environmental movement.
If you go to my website, there is a book review called Dowie's Conservation Refugees. And within that, there is a sub-essay called Conservationism's Recruitment of an Indigenous Auxiliary, 1974 to 2007. And in that, I actually have to supplement what Dowie had to say, but it has been a strategy of the environmental movement for over 40 years to create a puppet sub-movement of Aboriginal people to basically create parks to block development of large areas. America has definitely been a victim of that, and you certainly see it, you know, Seattle and around, you know, Oregon, Washington, those states there, and other places, New Mexico, California. Other countries that have been major victims of this campaign are Australia. The Aborigines movement there is very much aligned with the environmental movement. Brazil, the whole Amazon area, you'll say, well, we can't, you know, turn this jungle into a farm because there are these Indians in there. One particularly violent Indian tribe in Brazil has been given an area the size of Austria, you know, for them to look after as a park. There's 7,000 of these Indians. It's probably the, you know, the greatest waste of land on the planet. And of course, they're not living their traditional lives anymore. Now they're all walking around with rifles and radios and preventing anyone from entering their territory. And they're all being paid for this. And of course, international celebrities like Sting and what have you go down there and sing their praises. But this is an international strategy. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature and the World Wildlife Fund and, you know, the United Nations Indigenous Peoples Forum and what have you. There's several major international organizations that have been, you know, beavering away on this for well over a generation.
I like
they have
that.
Created this.
We're stealing that beavering away on this. That's a great word picture.
It
really is.
You're a Canadian here.
Okay. You can see them out there getting their little sticks.
The beaver is the national animal of Canada.
Oh, God, we are just getting
this
some,
is so cool.
We're getting
Did
some
not know
Canada
that.
One. We talked to Elizabeth Nixon a couple of months ago. She didn't tell us anything
about this.
Don't go to her website because she's very angry with me.
Oh, she is? Okay.
Yeah, she has devoted a very lengthy essay criticizing my criticisms of her. Not that we were ever pals or on speaking terms or have ever seen each other, but that's not likely to transpire now.
Don't I just always have the most uncanny knack of scab picking? Sorry, I brought it up.
It's perfectly acceptable. I hope people do go to our website. If anybody wants, I'm not going to respond to that. It's if anyone is literate, they can see that what she is saying is balderdash and that she's made some very serious errors and her much of, yeah, I said her book was very good, but at the end of my review of her book, I did make a list of all the just basic mathematical errors that I'd found in the book. And this has made Queen Elizabeth very angry.
Isn't it interesting? Even in the people who are criticizing the environmental community, there are different takes on that. You know, we're just not designed to all be in the same rut. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
we need our own.
You know, you got communities inside communities
exactly.
inside communities.
That's funny. Little side note there. Okay, so
do you want to know the scariest part of this Indian uprising?
Okay.
It is that the police are siding with the Indians.
Oh, oopsie.
There's an absolutely terrifying book written by a senior Canadian journalist, and the book is called Helpless, Caledonia's Nightmare of Fear and Anarchy. And there was a small town in Ontario. There's a context to this. I don't know. It'd take me probably too long to explain it. But they were planning a major suburban project of 450 houses. Everyone was very happy. The developers were sure they were going to make $30 million in profit. And then a nearby native reserve, which is Canada's largest reserve, called the Six Nations Mohawk Reserve. Incidentally, who were all people who fought against the American Revolution, the Six Nations Mohawk Reserve, as with a lot of Central Canadian Indians in Canada. These were people who fought with the British against the Americans, and after that war, like in the 1780s, they fled America because they knew what was going to happen to them now, and they came to Canada. And anyways, the Six Nations Reserve put together this absolutely ridiculous land claim on this subdivision, which was, you know, this 450-house subdivision that was in the midst of being constructed. No level of government thought there was any merit to this land claim. It went nowhere in the courts. Then the natives just violently occupied the subdivision. They riotously attacked the police. And then the Ontario Provincial Police, in their wisdom, placed a Mohawk in charge of the policing. This is a person who had known contacts with the Mohawk Warrior Society, which is recognized as a criminal enterprise on both sides of the border. And it's a major tobacco smuggling enterprise. And he proceeded to turn the police around. So all they did was support the Indians against the locals. There were riots on a weekly basis in this town, sometimes involving as many as 3,000 people. Ultimately, the Indians set up blockades right through the middle of the town, and they demanded to physically search any white person going through the blockades. And this was quite often, you know, drunk Indians at midnight demanding to physically body search women. A lot of women ended up sleeping in their cars, sleeping at friends' places to avoid going through this blockade at certain times of the night. There was, numerous examples chronicled in this book of white people being physically beaten up with half a dozen police officers standing 10 paces away. On one occasion, two journalists from a television station were beaten up and had their tape stolen out of their camera. One of them was left with a giant gash on the top of his head. There was half a dozen cops watched this happen. When it was over, one of the cops walked over and told him to sue our police force, sue the Ontario Provincial Police Force, because we are being told not to intervene when any Native activity like this. And this is not a made-up story. I recall following this in some news media while it was happening, but it was a clear example at very high levels in the police departments. They're being infiltrated or co-opted or whatever, so that the order coming down the line is not to interfere in these Native protests. And we're seeing it again. About 2 weeks ago, Natives, there's about, at most there was 15, usually 6 of them, blocking a major rail line into the city of Sarnia. That branch line fed a number of chemical plants, propane plants, what have you, that were vital to the economy of the area. And the owners of the railway, the Canadian National Railway Company, sent their lawyers to court. They got a court injunction to have the police remove those people from the tracks, and the police refused to obey the injunction. And they went back to court again. We don't have subpoenas in Canada. We have summonses. The judge summoned the chief of police to his courtroom. He wanted to go eyeball to eyeball with him and say, "Why are you not enforcing my orders?" Eventually, after about 2 weeks of non-enforcement of a court order, they took the barricade down, and the chief of police of Sarnia helped the natives fold their flag and participated in their ceremonies when they took the blockade down. That has happened several times in Canada in the last 2 weeks, where there's been these ridiculous blockades of railways or highways, and usually there's not that many people there. It wouldn't be a major policing operation just to arrest them. But the police don't do anything. They just stand there. And this is infuriating Canadians, non-Native Canadians. In fact, the judge who issued that order then went public, and his final words is, "I don't get it." You don't need a judge's order to get people off a main rail line. That is a crime in progress. It reminds me a lot of the Occupy movement. You will recall you had Occupy in the States.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right.
Quite often they were on private property or they were trespassing on public property and the police are standing around. And a lot of citizens in Canada, the United States, say, you know, why don't you simply remove these people from the park? Why don't you remove them from the street? And for some reason, you're talking to a stone wall when you talk to the police in those settings. And this is really happening in Canada. And there's the one little video clip I think you guys downloaded of a woman just driving right through one of these blockades. And if the police weren't there, people would be going through these human blockades at 120 miles an hour. Most of the non-native population are furious, and there's probably been about 50 mainstream media articles in the last 2 weeks complaining about police passivity. In Alberta, the province I'm in right now, the justice minister recently came out and said, you know, his quote was, "I am pissed off at the police because they're not doing anything." In Alberta, we don't have a provincial police. We've just got city polices, and then we've got the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And they are notorious for siding with the Indians. In fact, that whole police force was created to protect the Indians from the settlers. And that seems to live on. But what it really is that very high levels of government, they've been co-opted. They support the movement. They support the environmental movement. They support the efforts to convert the Aboriginals into an auxiliary for the environmental movement. And that is why there's such a potential for violence. Mm-hmm. And it ultimately, you know, they're threatening now. There's a chief who's basically a professional environmentalist who's threatening to block what's Highway 63, which separates, you've heard of the oil sands, the tar sands. That's their main highway. He's threatening to blockade that.
Hey, William, and I've got a quick question before we go to break. If you look at the numbers, the environmental movement teaming up with the Native Americans, what percentage of the population are they in the country of Canada? Are
in Canada?
Yeah.
Aboriginals, all those who self-identify as Aboriginals come to 3.9%, below 4% of the total population.
Again, it's the minorities. It's
yeah,
running the show.
This is a minority.
Mathematical minorities. Exactly.
Yeah, they are one in about 33 of the population. And that's why it's such a big joke, because they're always threatening violence. Huh. If it was a real war, it would be the shortest war in history.
Yeah.
But they're getting away with it because they're basically being protected by the police. Like a lot of these blockades, 6 Aboriginals on the highway, 20 police cars. People would just drive right over them if the police weren't there. And the police will give advance notice that the highway is being closed. They reroute traffic around the blockade. They're facilitating these blockades. In their line is they don't want to see any violence.
It is like Occupy. All right, we've got to take a little break here and listen to some news. You can catch up on some American news, William. We'll be right back with William Kay here at We the People Radio. In 5 minutes, you're listening to KCNR 1460 AM.
KCNR Shasta Redding.
Yet another exciting edition of We the People Radio. You are joining your hosts, Elizabeth Woodward, Aaron Ryan, and Bob Martin, and our very special guest, William Kay.
And we're streaming again.
And we are streaming and chatting live. And Bob, kudos and hands off to you for multitasking better than any woman I know. Very, very good.
That is indeed a compliment.
It is.
I was going to say.
It was meant to be. Hats off to you. You do well under pressure.
All right.
Well, like we were saying last hour, we got this new streaming system in here. And to my knowledge, this was the first time it had really locked up in the last several days.
Yeah.
But it's unlocked, and that's progress. It's
that
working
is.
Again.
It's bad to find out when the system locks up that there's a password.
And you don't have it.
And you don't know what it is.
Yes, so, well.
Bummer.
Thanks to the webmaster for pointing me in the right direction.
And answering
that.
The phone early on Sunday morning. That
yes,
helps.
It's a Linux-based system rather than Windows or Mac. So I
okay.
But it's supposed to be more bulletproof. So So it's a good thing.
Great.
We think.
So we are chatting and streaming live at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Read everything about today's guest and every show that we've ever done. No excuse not to email that information out far and wide. And it's everything you will never hear in mainstream media. And we're talking today about the environmental movement. We think it's exclusive to the United States. It is so not true. And they're still the minority in creating havoc everywhere they go and teaming up with their useful idiots.
Yeah, teaming up with whoever will work for them. This is why these shows have a disclaimer at the beginning.
Yeah.
The opinions are that of the...
And we are not short on opinions,
all that,
are we?
No. And we always have people on that aren't short of opinions. But have we... William, are you back from the great silence?
Yes, I am.
Oh, right on. Okay. So where would you like to take us now?
We're going to take a voyage back 200 years.
Nice.
You recall the War of 1812?
Well, I wasn't there, but yeah. In general. Give us that first-hand report.
It actually lasted 2 years, from 1812 to 1814. And one of the central antagonists of the war was Tecumseh. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does that bang a drum?
Yes. Good one.
Well, Tecumseh, as you know, came to fame as someone who went around butchering and slaughtering white people in Kentucky and Ohio for encroaching on Indian territory. He is also a brigadier general in the British Army. His real name was Shooting Star. His brother had visions of someday wiping out all the white people in the world, at least on North America, which to them was the world. And they put together what was known as the Shawnee Confederacy. And the purpose of the Shawnee Confederacy was to block any further westward expansion of Europeans on the North American continent. And it was not the sole cause of the War of 1812. There was also the matter of, because the Napoleonic Wars were going on, the British were seizing American ships that were trading with Europe, and they were press-ganging American sailors into the British Navy. That was also a cause of the war. There were two causes. One, that the British were giving weapons and training to the Shawnee Confederacy to block westward expansion. And secondly, that they were, doing what they were on the Atlantic. As you know, at the end of the War of 1812, the Shawnee Confederacy was completely obliterated. Not totally. Just as a back lesson. During the Seven Years' War, which was in the 1760s, and which was fought primarily in North America, the Shawnee Confederacy sided with the French against the British, and they lost. During the American Revolution, they sided with the British against the Americans, and they lost. During the War of 1812, they sided with the British against the Americans, and they lost. And they hung enough of them survived to fight in the Civil War for the South. If they ever set up a casino, I will go there. Anyways, the point is that the British were using an Indian alliance to block expansion. So it shows how far back in history this goes. Like right now in Canada, we are primed for a major push into the north, where there is untold mineral resources. And there's a lot of money coming in from Asia that wants this to go forward. And the environmental movement, which is primarily driven by European interests, is forming this sort of native alliance to block this expansion. In fact, one of the things that caused the American Revolution was that Britain did not want the colonists to keep pushing further westward and northward. And they were aligning with natives to prevent that from happening. So there's over 200-year-old history of metropolitan European powers, pretty much the European aristocracy, aligning themselves with native groups in North America, in South America, in Australia, and elsewhere to block expansion. That's the unholy alliance there.
Well,
are you there?
Yeah.
We are.
No,
we're,
I guess I was just kind of pondering my
absorbing
my history, because I grew up on the East Coast, so I learned that history. And, they hadn't... I just was thinking back, they hadn't scrubbed that out of our books yet.
And,
I wonder if they're still teaching that.
We had a conversation recently about how history varies depending on what side of the states you're on. You know, if you're on the West Coast, you don't hear about.
Yeah, because did you learn about Tecumseh? Is that a familiar? Yeah, see, out here they don't do that. Interesting.
Yeah. On the West Coast.
Well, he's a hero here. It's amazing, you know, if you really look at the history of this person was, you know, a serious race warrior, criminal, and ultimately, you know, brigadier general in the British Army. That I did not know until recently.
Wow.
Bizarre.
So, now,
I was going to say, so as they're expanding, as you guys are looking at expanding, and we're talking business interest, correct? Going northward?
Yeah. Right now on the table, there's about $700 billion worth of mining projects that are just about ready to go or are in the process of going. There's all kinds of diamond mining, platinum mining, gold mining, but this requires a lot of roads and infrastructure development, and that is what's really being obstructed right now. But, once you get north of sort of where I'm at here, it's Alaska. In fact, Alaska is more densely populated than the Canadian North. You know, Alaska is this great metropolitan area compared to north of where I am. It is just straight bush for hundreds and hundreds of miles where there's nobody.
And so all these protests and all this big uprising is kind of designed to ultimately shut all that down?
It appears in almost every statement that they make that they're protecting Mother Earth, they're protecting Turtle Island. But, of course, the natives are divided because a lot of remote native groups are hoping to make money off of the mining and what have you, and a lot of them already have. It's basically a big shakedown operation. But there are certainly, there's a contingent of the native groups that want these mining projects to go ahead, and forestry projects and oil and gas projects, because they will get some money out of it. However, by empowering them, what we're basically doing is creating another level of government. And what a lot of these foreign companies do not want to see is, you know, some confusion as to who owns the land. Nobody's going to sink a large amount of money into an area if all these other groups keep popping up saying, well, it belongs to us. No, it belongs to us. And I can assure you that the area that they're under dispute in Canada, this is ceded territory. This is surrendered territory. Now, I've done something that, you know, 0.001% of North Americans have done. I've read these treaties. And with the exception of southern British Columbia, where there were no treaties, where it's kind of a legal quagmire, it is all absolutely surrender treaties. And if you get past all the verbiage and the, you know, analysis of the treaties and what have you, and read the treaties themselves, they are quite clear that the territory, that they use the phrase, that the Indians shall hereafter cede, yield up, surrender, release all claims, titles, and privileges to this area, and they will show you a map of where the area is. But they have created this myth that somehow the Indians are entitled to be consulted and compensated for anything that goes on. What the treaties say, that within the surrendered territory, there shall be reservations, but they usually represent about 1 or 2% of the land that's been surrendered. On the reservations, all the land is owned by the government. It is against the law, still against the law, for Indians to own land on a reserve.
Oh, really?
Which has done a lot to really undermine their ability to develop. So on the reserves, there is a requirement that if there's going to be any economic activity, that the natives must be, you know, consulted and compensated. But there's this myth that has been perpetrated by a big lie that applies to the whole country. It only applies to these tiny reserves. And the treaties are quite clear there that the government has the hammer. And if the natives don't want this railway to go across their reserve or this mine in the reserve, ultimately the government can do it even if they don't want it. But the natives have this view that they somehow have a veto over any sort of mine or railway or highway in the country, and that simply is not the law. But due to the, you know, the environmental movement, which of course is a family of movements, it's not just a, you know, it's in terms of sociological terms, you know, the environmental movement, the population control movement, the Aboriginal supremacist movement, these are all tightly connected organizations. But they have succeeded in convincing, you know, the entire Aboriginal population that these treaties are either invalid or the treaties themselves actually say the natives have this veto over all resource development, or they have a right to share in the revenues from those resources. There's nothing in those treaties about that. There's nothing in those treaties about free dental care. Now, these treaties were written in the 1870s. Do you think they were giving people free dental care?
Yeah. Highly doubtful.
Yeah.
You know, one of the treaties, Treaty Number 7, requires the federal government to drop off a first aid kit and a Winchester rifle at the Blackfoot chief's house. And that first aid kit has been, you know, blown up to that we've got to give them free medical care. And by the way, every treaty does say that the federal government is required to build schools on the reserves to teach them English, which is something, you know, although they complain about it now, it's something that every chief wanted in the treaties. They wanted their youth to be able to speak English. And now this is being treated as some great act of cultural genocide. In fact, there are now reserves in Canada that are unilingual. The education is unilingual Cree and unilingual Ojibwe. You know, this is something that started about 10 years ago. So now they're putting out people into our society who speak only Ojibwe. Boy, you can travel the world speaking that.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of those languages only had 2,000 words.
I don't know
how you say, you know, take your pickup truck to the airport in Cree. You know, it's a disaster, but there's this, you know, what's called the Aboriginal industry of Canada. You know, there's several hundred very well-paid professors and this whole bogus art market and a variety of other things, but there's thousands upon thousands of people who make their living in the Aboriginal industry in various government bureaucracies and you know, affirmative action programs and what have you, and they are just rolling back the great wheel of history. And you know, they keep talking about this genocide that occurred in Canada. According to Canadian Encyclopedia, the peak Aboriginal population pre-contact, Columbus sailing the ocean blue in 1492, was 350,000. So this is the genocide where, at the end of the day, they tripled in numbers. There's more Indians now in Canada than there ever was, you know, before Christopher Columbus. And it's not too much different to the United States, but now this has become this great political football, and the more the Aboriginal industry colonizes the universities, the more we're getting these outrageous estimates of what the pre-contact population was. Encyclopedia Britannica used to say that north of the Rio Grande, there was only 1 million Indians pre-contact. Now they've got figures, you know, several million, 10 million. They keep bumping this number up. Every retelling of the story, they keep exaggerating this number.
Kind of like Pinocchio.
What's that?
The Pinocchio factor.
Yeah, kind of like Pinocchio.
Well, it adds to this whole idea that there was some great, you know, enormous crime had been committed on them. And it's really an exaggeration. There were battles, but it was very much a two-way street. The settlers all down the road were victims of attacks by natives. You know, read the history of King Philip's Warrior. They almost, you know, they massacred one-third of all the Puritan towns, the Algonquins did on the East Coast. And that was a two-way battle. It wasn't as though, you know, white people showed up and just started hunting Indians. That was simply not the case in this country. It was so empty to begin with. There should have been no difficulty in coexisting, but battles did break out. And I am not saying that it was all evil on one side or the other, but the notion of genocide is really misleading. Their population never got wiped out. Even in places like Mexico, if you look at the Mexican population, and it's all such a dicey issue, but they're forcing it upon us. Overwhelmingly, the Mexican population is of mixed ancestry. It wasn't as though natives were exterminated. There still are millions of, I think there's 900,000 full-blood Mayans in Mexico right now, and there's other groups like that are still full-blood. But overwhelmingly, what they're calling the genocide was a process of intermarriage. So whereas the full-blood population has diminished in Mexico, you've got this huge population of people of mixed ancestry. That's not a genocide.
No.
That's a marriage.
That's a marriage.
That's a marriage on that note.
And we certainly see that in Canada. You know, there's this huge mixed population. It's actually, you know, by some estimates, you know, 80-90% of the people who are calling themselves Aboriginal have some European ancestry. It annoys me because, you know, I'm not a racist. Most Canadians are not racists. But this whole, what's happening now is just bringing this whole racial issue to the forefront. And what it's sounding like now, you ever recall the one drop rule?
The one drop rule?
In the pre-Civil War South, if you had one drop of African ancestry, you know, you were black and you could be a slave. So you had people who were like 1/16th black. Or, you know, people who were just absolutely, whole families were disgraced because it was pointed out that, you know, four generations ago there was an African. But they had, it was called the one-drop rule. And, you know, as far as the extreme racists were concerned, if anyone, anywhere in your ancestry had African and blood, you were black, end of the story. That's what we're getting to in Canada. I mean, they've recently, you know, it's a lower court decision. It's not a Supreme Court decision, but basically there was one that handed down about a few months ago that, you know, grants a lot of benefits and what have you to non-status Indians. And these are people who are, you know, 1/16th Native, 1/32nd Native. So we're getting to a point where if you can establish any Aboriginal ancestry, like one drop of Indian blood, you're going to be entitled to all of these benefits. And it's just a screaming injustice to everybody else.
Well, while we absorb that, we're going to come back in 2 minutes. We're going to thank our advertisers, folks that are still in business. Go figure. Many of them in business in California. That's even more of a minority. Listening to KCNR 1460 AM, community radio for the North State.
Land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Maybe I'll be there to shake your hand. Maybe I'll be there to share the land that they'll be giving away when we all live together. I'm talking about
and we're back. Hey, so how many people do you think watched the inauguration?
Canadian artist there, by the way.
Oh, really? Who is that?
Guess who?
Oh, nice. I didn't know they were Canadian.
The guess who?
The guess who? Who's on first? First what?
I don't know who's on third.
I couldn't resist.
Okay, so how many people do you think watched the inauguration?
Winnipeg, Manitoba.
What's that?
What's that, William?
The guess who? They were from Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Very
nice.
Good.
Nice.
I can remember my sister's getting one of their albums 40 years ago.
Because we're all very cool.
Let's go down memory lane. Anyways.
Yes.
Enough.
We're having some politically incorrect. I just want you to know you have spawned the politically incorrect chat in the chat room.
Yes, our chat room is extremely racist today.
Well, it's just politically. I'm not going to say it's racist. It's politically incorrect.
I don't think it is.
You're not as racist as the stuff that we're hearing coming out of Canadian Indians' mouths these days.
We've been,
that's the biggest joke.
We've been chatting about F Troop in there.
Let's put it this way. It would have to be one of the all-time top five politically incorrect chat sessions of Wizard People.
And one of our chatters found Indian artifacts on his property. What did he find? Acorns and Budweiser cans?
Yeah, something like that. Like I said, we've gone to politically incorrect.
We start off pretty polite, but it goes downhill pretty quick.
What the heck? You know, why can't you have a little fun on a Sunday morning? Let's not get our
panties in a wad.
There you go. I just censored myself.
Never do. Have you
that's
noticed?
Really hard for
me. I never do.
No, that was a nice thing to say. I was going to say something bad.
Right. Elizabeth is the unfiltered one.
I am.
Yeah, because the stuff that comes out of her mouth isn't really that bad. I hope she never starts channeling me. It'll ruin everything.
I know. I say what everybody else is thinking.
All right. Sorry, William.
Well, we're seeing a lot of that in Canada. Like the most of the major newspapers now, when they post things online, they have a comment section below that.
Oh.
And before this uprising, you know, usually there'd be 20, 30 comments posted after an article. If the article deals with Native affairs, this uprising, now there's like 500 comments, and it's nasty. Like the truth is coming out in the comments section. In fact, Natives protested out front of one of the newspapers in Winnipeg from the Sun newspaper chain. They want them to censor their comment sections because they can't bear to hear what, you know, people are saying about them.
It's amazing. I mean, after a while, you just, God, you know, it's like, come on.
Mm-hmm. But you get tired. Oh. You get tired of being told that you're a racist if you don't agree with someone else's point of view. Or as a way and they use it as a way to censor.
Yeah.
They're taking away our First Amendment racism. Rights. Yeah.
Is racism something that only the white devils do?
Yep.
That's what we're hearing in Canada. I mean,
you can
stand there and just denounce white people, the endless perfidy of the white man that we're hearing out of this native propaganda. If you resist it, in fact, one of the chief ideologues of the current uprising, he's a professor from the University of Victoria, probably pulling down around $200,000 a year. He was called Gerald Alfred. That was before he channeled his inner Hiawatha, and now he's calling himself Taika.
Bob just aspirated.
There's coffee all over the keyboard.
He's online and saying that anybody who denies the right of native groups to create their own states within North America is a white supremacist.
Oh, wow.
And that was printed in the... Yeah. So he wants, like, all these native reserves to have their own armies, their own criminal codes, what have you. Just absolutely nonsense, unworkable system that he's promoting. And that anybody who opposes this... And this guy's a full professor. He runs a Department of Indigenous Governance out of the University of Victoria. And he's saying things like that. He's also online of calling another Canadian journalist a racist prick. And he also threatened to kick another journalist's ass. This guy's got a PhD. Oh. He published a book from Oxford.
He's one of their chief spokespeople.
Hey, you got the button.
We got to use the button. You should have seen Bob. He was like Superman.
So we know we can say crap, but that's
okay,
it.
Okay, there are some words we can't actually say on this show.
And we've never seen him.
He has appeared in a mainstream newspaper. You know, I guess I could say.
That was funny.
Would you understand the P word? Not likely.
We've been here 2.5 years, and that's a first. Yay.
Jeez, Bob. Okay. Bob's like light. We're gonna call him lightning fast today. That was great.
Well, you know what? I have to get a ruling on that word. We might be able to get away with it, but when in doubt, bleep it out. You know.
Well,
I didn't know that. That's pretty funny. But, so go ahead. Go ahead, William.
During the course of this uprising, I'm seeing more and more foul language in the mainstream media. It just shows that the tenor of the debate is just rising and rising here as it goes on. And you're seeing a lot of headlines that have swear words in them now.
Yeah. Well, and then you have What's Her Face on New Year's Eve. And
oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like, the heck? Yeah.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Bad deal.
What's Her Face on New Year's Eve?
Some rude comedian woman who thinks she's funny, Kathy somebody or other.
Oh, well, Kathy Griffin.
You know, she has virtually no career, so she goes to extreme measures to create one.
Yeah, you could probably write her monologue though.
By the way, that wasn't bleeped on the stream; it was only bleeped on the over the air AM broadcast.
Oh, really?
Yes, you can say whatever you want on the stream.
We've always wanted to know how that works, William. Thank you so much for that free education.
Yeah, we've been waiting 2.5 years to push that button.
We just threw away 5 minutes of the show just talking about having to bleep something. That's pretty fun. So, okay. So you guys are all, anybody who's opposing this, this whole, what's it called? Like a revolt or?
Well, it's calling itself Idle No More.
Yeah, I saw that. What does that mean? They're just not taking it anymore?
Well, a lot of people pointed out that, you know, we've been referring to the natives as rather lazy for the last 200 years, so maybe now that they're idle no more, it means like lazy no more. But it was a word concocted by Sheila McLean of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, who is also, you know, 100% European, but she's one of the intellectual leaders of this uprising. And it basically, they're not going to sit around on their couches anymore. They're going to get out in the streets and get active. They're not going to be idle anymore. That's what they were thinking when they came up with it. The movement's already been largely hijacked by the tribal dictators away from the academics.
Oh, okay.
Important point. This relates to the environmental movement. Mm-hmm. It has been a revelation to a lot of people that a lot of environmental non-government organizations are being bankrolled by wealthy philanthropists. I've been writing about that on my website for 14 years. The first thing I posted was an essay called The American Oligarchy's Economic Warfare Campaign Against British Columbians, and I just chronicled a number of local environmental groups that were getting money from the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Brothers and the Hewletts and the Packards and what have you. And this was a revelation to people. And it's even more of a revelation lately as more of the mainstream media in Canada and elsewhere clue into this. But they're way behind the times. The real power of the environmental movement and groups like, or one of the real powers behind the environmental movement and groups like the Aboriginal supremacist movement emanates out of the universities. Every university in North America and Western Europe has environmental studies departments and ecology departments, earth sciences departments that are saturated and loaded wall to wall with full-on political activists. And this is what's called a semi-institutionalizing movement. It is a movement that has become so big it has embedded itself into the government and it is appropriating government resources to do its bidding, which is great news for the philanthropists because it makes their dollars go all the further. This was one of their goals and it succeeded very well. And we've certainly seen this in Canada regarding, and the United States, you know, one of the great demonic enterprises of the universe is the Ford Foundation. And in the 1960s, the Fords, who, if anyone's looked at the history of that family, you know, indubitably neo-Nazi. Read the history of Henry Ford.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's an aside. In the 1960s, they really began this push towards Aboriginal supremacism. And one of their concoctions was the Indian Studies Department at UCLA. And that is pretty much the mecca and the blueprint of Indian studies or Native studies or Aboriginal studies departments right across North America. And I went to the trouble of counting all the Native studies programs of various ilk just across Canada. There is now 216 university-level Native studies programs. You can get a BA degree in Indian pedagogy or, you know, post-colonial anti-racism. You can get a master's degree at York University in that. So right across Canada now there's over 200 of these programs being offered, and they're basically, you know, ultra pro-native, ultra anti-white settler. We're not humans anymore now, we're just settlers. We're people who don't really belong here. We didn't rise out of the soil like they did. And most of these programs are race-based in terms of who gets to teach the program. They try to get as many Aboriginals or people who identify themselves as Aboriginals teaching those programs. The students in those classes would be overwhelmingly people who self-identify as Native. And if they actually do have Native status, their entire education will be paid for by the government. So what we've got in Canada now, and these are the real sort of bastions or the real cells of this social movement. And there's a lot more going on than that, but this is a very important aspect of it. Just as with the environmental movement, you know, go to any university and you will find these environmental classes. You'll also find environmental student societies. These are the real nests, these are the bastions, the cells of the social movement. And the heck of it all is the taxpayer is funding this.
Yeah, that's what we see down here. We see the taxpayers paying for both sides of the whole argument. They pay to sue themselves, and then they pay when they lose. We need to take
who controls these universities?
We have to take a really quick break here because we were tardy goofing off with the bleep out button. We'll be right back with you here at We the People Radio. You heard it here first. KCNR 1460 AM, Community Radio for the North State.
My father married up your Cherokee. My mother's people were ashamed of me. The Indians said that I was white by all I ever heard.
Well, that's just embarrassing. To be known as Idiot America.
I like it. Bob said that's part of a two-parter. We have to wait till the next break to find out.
And he isn't going to give us any clues.
The rest of the story. All right, William, talk fast.
Okay.
We're coming into the home stretch. We still have to squeeze in another break.
Home stretch. One of the main points of confusion is that many people view the capital T, capital M, the movement, environmental movement and its allies, as being a left-wing movement, as to being somehow descendant from the socialist, communist, Marxist scene. That is completely inaccurate. This is a movement that arises out of the fascist movement. Now, supporting, or I should say opposing this, or pointing this out, does not mean that you're supporting socialism or communism by calling the environmental movement fascist. The correct approach is to oppose both neo-fascism and socialism, but it's also important to point out that those two are quite distinct phenomena. The actual real radical left is pretty much a dead phenomenon in the Western world, whereas the fascist movement is on the doorsteps of power. And if you look at people like Obama, they're actually in power. But the environmental movement, this is a movement indubitably of the extreme right. People confuse the extreme right of today with various aspects of old versions of the right. In 1941, you know, between the gates of Moscow and the White Cliffs of Dover, every European country was under the rule of a fascist dictator. There were about 7 or 8 million Europeans who brandished membership in fascist political parties. Contrary to popular opinion, there was no great purge after World War II. Many of those people laid low for a few years, and they began to reorganize. And what they reorganized into was the environmental movement. If you know the history of fascism, you'll realize it was an extremely green movement. They all used terms like ecology. They were into conservation, wilderness preservation. All the leading neo-Nazis and fascists were great promoters of these things. That much they did not change. But many, they dropped, certainly, when the fascist movement reorganized, there was always this sort of fringe that couldn't let go of the swastikas and couldn't let go of the crude anti-Semitism. But they were very much marginalized and ghettoized. The mainstream of the neo-fascist movement pretty much reconstituted itself into what we now call the international environmental movement. And its objective is to impose dictatorial kinds of government where there's very, very regulated forms of capitalism. They're not going to completely abolish private property, as some people think, but they are going to switch to a highly regulated system, and they are going to greatly restrict land development into the metropolitan areas, and the hinterlands are going to be desiccated and let to wither up and dry. That is the agenda that we're looking at now. And one of the key features of how fascism takes power is through a steady recruitment of the state elite and the capturing of state institutions. This isn't the unwashed mob sweeping the Bastille. Many European governments were taken over by fascist political parties that just selectively recruited police chiefs and judges and professors, and by the time they had sufficient grasp of the state machinery, it was too late for most people to realize. When we see, like in the United States right now, a lot of the universities are completely out of the control of the elected legislatures. These legislatures give all kinds of money to these universities, but somehow it's considered completely inappropriate for them to interfere with academic freedom. And out of these universities, there's this well-coordinated political agenda being broadcast, and they're indoctrinating the youth into this agenda, even though the vast majority of the public don't agree with this agenda, and they're paying for it. And we're seeing, you also see a lot of the agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency. They're completely out of the control of the American public. That is a fascist system where the democratic institutions get marginalized. And it's not as though there are no people influencing these government bureaucracies. Other groups are. But your Senate and your Congresses and your state legislatures are becoming these mere talking shops. Even the politicians don't even know what's going on in these state bureaucracies. That's fascism. It is the pounding of a wedge between the elected representatives and the government machinery itself. And we're seeing it big time in Canada now when we can't get the police to arrest people that are blocking main rail lines and highways like that. And there's a great deal of public fury, just a realization that someone has got there ahead of us. And that at the very elite levels of these police departments, there are political agents, there are actors who are influencing it. And the rank and file police will just do what they're told. So government agency by government agency are being stripped away from the elected representatives and being circled around other elements within the society. That is a slow, creeping process of fascist takeover.
Yeah, and we're much of it is being called regionalism, which we just super love. So, okay, we've got to squeeze in one more break here, and then we'll come right back, and we will tie up this hour with William Kay. Hang in there. You're at KCNR 1460 AM, Community Radio for the North State.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind. From the north and south and east.
Don't wanna be a Canadian idiot. Don't wanna be some bear swill and hockey nut. And do I look like some frostbitten hose head? I never learned my alphabet from A to Z.
Oh, that's great. I get it. So you were going to do the Weird Al Yankovic part.
That's
second half.
Fun.
Super
fun. Expensive American idiot, yes.
Yeah. I love
hey,
it.
Just real quickly, just wanted to let the folks in this area know that tomorrow night at the Reading Tea Party, 6 o'clock, 2570 South Bonneview Road at the Destiny Fellowship Church, where we meet every Monday night and have for about 3 years, we will be having Mike Stewart speaking to us. He is actually a really solid figure in the Shasta County area. He was a colonel in the Army, former principal and superintendent, principal of Enterprise High School, superintendent of the Enterprise High School District. He does live in Reading. He is a local expert on education and gun issues when it comes to the schools. And he's got some really strong feelings about gun control, and we can't wait to hear about that. So if you are tuned into the Second Amendment, if you attended any rally anywhere in the near Shasta County area, join us tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, Destiny Fellowship Church, because we will continue that thread of discussion.
Nice. Okay, so there's our commercial announcement. Thank you, Brenda, for working on that this morning. She was lining that up. We were hoping to be able to announce that, but I had the wrong phone number for him. Oopsie.
Go, Brenda.
Go, Brenda. Okay. Let's see. T-minus five and counting.
So, William, hockey season opened yesterday.
Hit it, William.
I actually don't follow hockey.
Good for you. Just say no to sports. It's just too time-consuming.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah, I don't. You can get addicted to those things. And
exactly.
Spending your whole life watching television, which I don't do.
He's the one Canadian who's not excited about it. The hockey season had been delayed for like 3 months because of a lockout, but it finally got underway yesterday.
Oh, you guys had that too? Oh, what the heck?
Yeah, well, they call it the National Hockey League, but it's actually international. Hmm. Yeah, it was huge news here. A lot of people were suffering greatly because of this, because there are a lot of people who are obsessed with hockey. It is not technically the national sport. The national sport is lacrosse, because we must honor the Aboriginals. But in reality, this is hockey country. floor to board. No doubt about that.
Nice. Okay, so we were talking about environmental fascism, which we love to talk about, and how that tangles up with the... Now, okay, so you keep calling them Aboriginal, so that's a good thing, or...
Okay,
well,
tell
as I say in Canada, whatever word we apply to these people within 3 years becomes considered
racist.
To be a racist epithet.
So what's the difference between Aborigines and Aboriginals?
Well, Aborigines are from Australia. That's what they call the people who were there when we arrived. Basically, it means your ancestors were there a long time. Of course, I'd like to call them Beringians because they arrived over the Bering Strait. During the last ice age, 15,000 years ago, because the water levels were so low, because so much water was trapped in ice, off the coast of the Pacific Ocean, there were great masses of land, and you could travel from Asia to North America. And that is when these people migrated. You see, they're immigrants. The Aboriginals, the Indians, they immigrated here. And although they don't like that, they believe that the Creator put them on the back of Turtle Island, and that they were always here. And they hate to hear the fact they, too, had migrated here from another place. But there was... And there is no Atlantis beneath the Atlantic Ocean, but there is a buried continent beneath the Pacific Ocean called Beringia, which appears during ice ages. And countries like places like Hawaii are giant islands because the sea level could be as much as 600 feet lower than it is now. And you can walk from China to Washington State.
Wow. Well,
and that buried continent is known by geologists as Beringia. Anyway, that's where they're from. They came from Asia.
Okay.
So technically, you know, they're not Aboriginals. They didn't evolve here as a separate species. Although I hate to hear it, when they created the National Museum in Ottawa for Aboriginal people, Aboriginal pressure made them eliminate all references to that. And now the official line is that the Creator put them here.
Hmm.
On North America.
And is your history all being rewritten to reflect all this?
Every word.
Of course.
In fact, they're coming up with written Aboriginal languages for people who had no writing.
Oh.
And they're teaching their kids in school how to write in Eskimo, not that they use that word anymore, even though these people had no written languages. It's an absolutely preposterous bit of revisionism. I think we're getting near the top of the hour. I want to boost the website.
Yes, please.
www.ecofascism.com or Google the words environmentalism is fascism or any word like that. I pretty much own those phrases and those words. And it's important for people. And America is going through a similar process. America has vast natural resources, timber, mine, oil, and gas, that you are not being allowed access to. Half of the land west of Chicago was owned by the U.S. federal government. You know, it's a no-brainer. You want the economy to boom, throw that land open for development.
Thank you, William K.
Unprecedented boom.
Right on.
Thanks a lot, William.
Boom.
Thanks, William.
Boom.
Time to go boom now. Casey and Ari Shasta Redding.